This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Kevin Baker, who's well-known, I think, as an author, primarily a novelist, author of Dreamland and a number of other books. But today I'm talking to him about his first graphic novel, which is called Luna Park, and which he collaborated with an artist named Daniel Zezelj. Did I pronounce that right?
He pronounces it Zezelj. As far as I have trouble with it too.
Where is he from?
It's Zezelj. He is from Croatia and is an amazing graphic artist.
It's an amazing book. Now, just for people who may not be familiar with the distinction about graphic novels, comics, etc., but a graphic novel has kind of evolved into it's a book, usually a book-length story told in words and pictures, and that's how I would describe it.
Yeah.
And of course, Luna Park fits that description. Since I know that your background is primarily in writing, I would call it traditional fiction and nonfiction. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the genesis of Luna Park and how, and I guess, we can talk a little bit about the story. I don't want to give it away.
Sure.
As a kind of, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who might want to read it.
Yeah, this is quite a departure for me. In many ways, an easier book to do. It's always easier when you leave off half or more of the work to somebody else. Instead of having to, write that compelling descriptive scene, you just leave it to the artist. So I hardly recommend it. But of course, it does contain its own challenges and difficulties. But it was really a fun thing to try to branch out into.
Well, so was this something that your publisher on this is Vertigo, which is a division of DC.
Yeah.
Did they come to you, or did you go to them? How did that work?
Yeah, they had approached me, and at the time I was deep into another book, so I had to put them off for a while, and then I got around to passing a couple of proposals up to them, and they really wanted something to do with Coney Island and something to do with gangsters. So I put together this idea about, just kind of thought up this idea about gangsters, but that also involves Coney Island nowadays, but also in its amazing past.
Right, and the story, I think, is kind of well put together as a multi-level story. It has surprises, and, there's a kind of science fiction quality to it as time is circular.
Yes, exactly. It has time travel and all those good comic book things. I think of all places in the United States, Coney Island really lends itself to this sort of treatment because it's a place where many times seem present at once. It's also a place where reality always seems to be about to kind of slip away. It's on the very edge of land, very edge of the continent here. And things just sort of seem to, and your concept of reality just seems to evaporate at times when you're down there.
Right. Well, and of course, that's the nature of an amusement park as well, that it's playing, often you think about those, the rides where you're fooled into thinking you're somewhere else, or you've got the distortions of who you are in the mirrors. The amusement parks really do traditionally play with reality.
Very much so. And Coney Island, of course, was the place where the first real amusement parks were built. And it's always been a place where things have been built over other things. So you always have little vestiges of the past peeking out here and there. And you always have a feeling that things are temporary and just very changeable.
Well, and in your story, your main character is a former, he's a Russian, but a former Russian fighter in the army. And he's got a, as they say, a checkered past. with a lot of pain and suffering, and there's a kind of theme of lost love and kind of desperation of trying to save somebody and not being able to. That kind of is a recurring motif. And so he's the one who's connected to the gangsters, the Russian mafia, I guess,
yes,
of the present day. So I mean, I think it's a beautiful story, and it really is kind of it very evocative. And you know, I think you've got you do have this feeling of time moving, all you know, and reality being fluid throughout.
Thanks very much. Yeah, the main character is Alec, who is somebody who, as you say, you know, went to Chechnya as an idealistic young Russian soldier and got very disillusioned with the war there, and tried very much to save someone he loved, and everything sort of backfired. So now he's looking to make amends in some ways, and he's seeing a kind of a mysterious fortune teller out in the ever-changing Coney, and at the same time he's working as kind of a Starka, kind of an enforcer for one of the Russian mobs down there, and things are about to come to a head as one of the mobs is making a move to kind of take over the whole area.
Well, you know, it's funny too. I was thinking about, you know, when I interview authors about their books, you know, we're dealing with written ideas as the as pretty much the subject.
Right. But
in talking to you about this book, the complication is that we're also talking about the visual presentation, and I find that much harder because I'm probably not as adept at describing. I'm not an art critic. I've read a lot of comics and graphic
right.
novels, and I feel like they're part of my life. But I don't have I don't think I have the language to do it justice in a certain way, but I think the style here of Zhezhe is, it's kind of very European. You know, there's a big difference between European-style graphic novels and American-style graphic novels, and what I've learned over the years is that a lot of Americans don't understand the visual language of Spanish or French graphic novels. But this book, while it has some elements of that style, there's a certain, you know, use of a lot of black and a lot of gray, but I think it does translate well. In other words, I don't think it's so European in style that it would make it difficult for an American graphic novel reader to enjoy it.
Yeah, very much so. You know, and I sort of have the same lack of criteria that you mentioned. First DC was kind of trotting out different artists, you know, and showing their work to me, and I was inside, well, that's, you know, as somebody who can't draw at all, I was, oh, well, that's fantastic. But I think Danielle really captured it more than anyone. I think he really, as you say, does kind of get across the whole film noir aspect of the story with this wonderful kind of feeling of dark and shading. And yeah, he's very European. In fact, there's a blurb on the book from Federico Fellini saying, "I'm fascinated by Zhezhe's threatening and ghostly perspectives, the way he manages to use his stories and characters to express the sense of melancholy of some impending doom." And I think, when you get that sort of tribute from Fellini, it's quite something. And I wouldn't describe the artwork as Fellini-esque, but it does have this great sort of noir quality. And he would, it was interesting working with him in the sense of, he speaks, of course, terrific English, like all Europeans do. But occasionally there'd be like little glitches in communication. And even when that happened, what he came up with on his own, I think really lent a lot to the book, you know, really made it better in every case.
So as a collaboration, which of course this is in that way also different from what we would consider to be traditional, you know, narrative
yeah.
fiction, did you spend time talking to him? Did you meet with him? How did you work together on that?
Yeah, we met, and I did talk to him, and then I had the idea, and I wrote up the script, and gave that to him to work with, and he very diligently researched things about Coney Island and Brighton Beach, where the story is set. But he, you know, and I gave him various works on the old Coney Island. But he very much took it from there. And I, you know, generally let him lead, since he was somebody with much more experience at doing this and is such a talented artist. And it would work out, you know, as I was saying, with kind of the occasional communications glitches. At one point, I described a scene on Ocean Boulevard, this beautiful old Frederick Law Olmsted, you know, the guy who built Central Park, designed boulevard in Brooklyn, where of a Friday, of a Saturday night, you can go by and see a lot of the Hasidic and Orthodox individuals, Jewish individuals who live there, kind of after the Sabbath, taking a stroll in the summer. And it's a very nice, beautiful scene. And he kind of misinterpreted the Ocean Boulevard part, and instead had sort of an Orthodox family down by the literal ocean, holding hands after the end of the Sabbath. But it works great. You know, it's a fantastic scene that he came up with, very interesting and almost haunting.
Did you find that after you saw some of the you know, the illustrations that it made, did you change any of the text to, you know, after you saw the illustrations, kind of using that as a spinning, you know, kind of a spin-off to rethink your writing?
Yes, at times, in terms of fitting things into the page and how it would go in the page.
Right.
He would take it and maybe change things in certain ways, and I would say, oh, okay, that, you know, you're right, that does work better. It was really a learning experience for me all through. You know, I mean, occasionally I would insist on some plot point going on because it had to make the story make sense, but for the most part, I would, you know, I really followed his lead, and I think it was a good decision.
No, it came out really well, and I think it's, you know, aside from this kind of feel for the emotion that you get, you know, because an illustration, illustrations can be evocative and give you a sense of the kind of visualization of someone's emotion in a different way than words do. I think it's really, you know, it doesn't mean I think this is better than straight narrative, or that, right, you know, straight fiction is better than graphic novels, but I think that in a really good way, this gives you a kind of, it's sort of like a movie versus a book. There's something different about the way illustration works to evoke emotion and give you an entry point into the story. And I thought, you know, I do think it was a good collaboration. You obviously worked well together. And he did capture your, you know, this kind of dreaminess. You know, the your character Alec, in fact, is also, he shoots heroin, which is, you know, pretty grim. But it also kind of that dreaminess of the heroin is in there too.
Oh, good. I'm glad that came across. Yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun to collaborate with him. And I think your description of the graphic novel is very apt. I mean, I think at this point, what graphic novels have come to be in this country is kind of a really interesting sort of connecting bridge between more traditional fiction and visual media, such as movies and television, which is probably why so many now are being adapted, to the movies and television. You know, I think it really combines that sort of, you know, restless and very visual media in a very visually oriented country, increasingly oriented country.
Right, and, you know, it's interesting, too, when you think about this, that, you know, now culture always reinforms itself, so that, you know, in the same way that manga, Japanese manga and anime, was highly influenced by Disney, so that there were all these cultural attributes that were taken from an American art form and then reinterpreted into Japanese, and then the Japanese anime and manga comes to America, influences then the re-influences the American audience. And in the same way, I think what you just described has happened with graphic novels, that the graphic novel has influenced film, but film has then re-influenced the graphic novel.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, I think you might be right about that. I mean, I certainly always, you know, as an American growing up, when I did, I certainly always think in terms of film images and very, very film-oriented. I think nowadays other people coming up might think more in terms of television. It's interesting how much these sort of series, particularly on cable TV, seem to be influencing the whole culture Yeah, sort of the Mad Men and Sopranos, things like that.
Yeah. No, I think, in fact, radically, you know, and even though not everybody watches them, the big difference today, of course, is, you know, we're much more fragmented, so that in, you know, 1960, everybody in America watched the same shows.
Yeah.
So it became a common language for the culture. And now if you look at, you know, 2010, 50 years later, there really isn't as much common language because there are so many different channels, as it were, available to us. We can literally create our own cultural environment. And while I may watch A, B, C, D, E, different, whether it's shows or videos or movies or internet stuff, and I may read, you know, 10 different books, you could be sitting right next to me and have a completely different experience.
Right, and I wonder what that will do to this culture. I mean, in some ways, America has always been adept at eventually blending these cultures. I mean, Americans 100 years ago tended to live in extremely different worlds, and it didn't prevent us from coming together as a functioning democracy. On the other hand, as a lot of people have mentioned nowadays, people almost seem to be creating their own realities, particularly when it comes to politics.
Right,
you know,
right.
You watch your own news channel, which has your point of view, and then you go to, you know, like somebody will go and watch their network shows, or somebody else will go and watch their cable shows, and after a while, you wonder if it will just create an entirely, you know, it'll just create viewpoints that are like just simply cannot be compromised or melded.
Right. Well, that's a risk, I think, of
yeah.
the, you know, the kind of model that we're falling into now. On the other hand, if you think about, you know, maybe millions of people read Newsweek and Time, and those were the two main sources of kind of interpretive information for millions and millions of people, which we all shared at a certain point.
Right.
Today, I might read that. I might not read one of those magazines. Instead, I read a blog, and I get all of my news and information from, let's say, you know, pick one. And you get your, it's slanted slightly differently. You'll get your same news and information from a different blog. And as you said, that may mean that we are have a sort of irreconcilable view of reality. On the other hand, we are not accepting the kind of authoritative view of a single or dual entity. You
yes.
know, it's kind of like the breakup of the two-party system, that people actually aren't so bifurcated that they fall easily into two separate strains of thought. You know, that maybe Americans are now, with 350 million people, you know, coming to this, and just like the rest of the world, too, you know, kind of noise level. Now, that could be a problem for,
yes.
for governance, but in terms of culture, it makes things very, very interesting. Now, it does actually lead me to another thing I wanted to talk to you about, kind of almost perfectly.
Okay.
Recently, you were the writer of a television show itself on A&E, which was a 10-hour series called America, the Story of Us. And
yeah.
you also then wrote a book. And, I mean, there are two things that were kind of connected to Luna Park. One is that America, the Story of Us is highly illustrated and is actually a different kind of book than the traditional narrative historical text.
Right.
And the show, of course, talks about a lot of the, you know, kind of the history of America in a different way.
Right, right. I was actually a consultant on the show, but then, yes, wrote the companion volume. And we try to kind of take American history a little more thematically, you know, and talk about it in terms of here's kind of all the westward expansion before the Civil War in one chapter. You know, here is sort of the industrial development and how these things interact with what the society is going to become. How the, you know, the cotton gin makes slavery a going, ensures that it will be a going enterprise in the South and leads us to the Civil War. You know, the industrial role of things like the development of the Lowell Mills and the whaling create, you know, how these things interact and how they created very different societies in the North and South, you know, so we take it in that way. But, you know, getting back for a moment to your point before about the different cultures, I will say, too, that it often seems very forced and false when we try to kind of force upon ourselves some exercise in being a common culture, like when you'll have it at, you know, Oprah or somebody will have, like, everybody in the city will read this book for this time, or everybody in this college campus will read this book, even though they're often great books. It just comes to seem silly. You know, it's like saying, like, you know, why doesn't everybody read what they want? I mean, call it a society, you know. It's sort of the same, you know, and it's historically, it's encouraging to look back. You know, 100 years ago, you had in New York City, for instance, not only 13 different newspapers coming out every day in English language, but numerous foreign language papers. You know, you had 250,000 people every day reading the Forward, the old Jewish Daily Forward. You know, so you think when that many people were reading, not even the same language, and yet we were able to have a thriving, functioning democracy. I think that's an encouraging thing about today.
Well, no, that's actually a good point. I think that you know, that when we think of America, we tend to think of it in terms that come to us rather than maybe how the country really was. And, you know, I thought there's one book I read years and years ago called The End of the American Era,
yeah.
I think, by Andrew Hacker. And he talked about how up until World War II, there were really very distinctive differentiations in American society, that there really was a class system in operation, and that there were huge differences between people who lived in the rural part of the country and people who lived in the cities, and there wasn't really a suburbia at that point. And World War II disrupted all the social patterns. You know, people who had never left rural Kentucky were, you know, in the army with people who were from all other parts of the country. And so it just changed the social relationships. And then, of course, after World War II, they didn't go back to where they came from. They went to new places.
Right. There's a terrific book that kind of hits upon some of those themes, too, called In the Time of the Americans by David Frumkin, F-R-O-M-K-I-N, and really kind of gets across what, even though the U.S. was the world's largest economy from, like, 70s on, there was still this, you know, it was still a tremendously primitive place by our standards today and by European standards, kind of disjointed, different country with certain huge urban powerhouses like New York or Chicago, but then this very rural existence. You know, it was a place where a huge portion of the country didn't even have electricity until late in the 30s and the 40s, where many people had had outhouses. You know, and this was kind of all changed, as you say, by by the reforms of the New Deal, by the movement into war, and by the rapid modernization after the war. You know, it really gets across sort of what a young country we are, and how really that culture really just was homogenized, just very lately.
But I wonder, thinking about that in terms of the definition of the culture, that one thing is true from that period. If you think from even in the 1800s and early, and much through the 1900s, the 20th century, that there was a sort of accepted canon of American thinking.
Yeah.
It didn't come from the vast majority of people. It, in fact, came from the most educated class talking to itself and talking to the country about what they thought the country was and should be.
Yeah.
So those defining categories of ideas really came from a relatively small number of people. And today, even though, you know, as you said, that you would have 250,000 people reading the Daily Forward, they were actually not feeding back into the canon of the society, at least directly, and not until much later, you know, where actually then you can talk about, you know, how immigrants altered the culture by their own activities, but they accepted the overriding themes of the society as their own. You know, the idea, the sort of Horace Greeley idea that anyone can make it, you know, those all were adopted by every immigrant group, everybody who came to America, everybody who lived here, well, with some exceptions, certain cultural groups perhaps not so, but the overall theme of the society was agreed upon on some level. And that seems less true today. You know, that as you know, even to go back to Luna Park, you've got people in America today who are not referencing those kind of accepted cultural values.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's, I think a lot of that is true, and there's a lot of things enforcing that. For instance, I'm always struck by how amazing American public monuments and public buildings were 100, 150 years ago. These kind of tremendous edifices, things like the, you know, Pennsylvania train, you know, station in New York or Grand Central, you know, all the sort of the public government buildings we would build, monuments were, you know, amazing, whereas most people were living in fairly squalid conditions. And that's kind of reversed today. Today our public buildings tend to be, if anything, rather underambitious. They generally have to be sponsored by a bank or a, you know, a hedge fund or something. And our, you know, we live so much more of our life internally in these, you know, in our McMansions and these kind of home oases. But at the same time, I think there was always, I think we maybe underestimate how much dissent there always was and how much struggle there always was. You know, I mean, I've written fictionally about three groups in New York, African Americans, Irish Americans, and Jewish Americans. And these were all groups who were welcome in this country only in the most subservient and subordinate, you know, and silent roles. And each of them sort of had to really fight and force their way up and challenge the existing power structure to the point where, you know, I don't think any three groups has done more to kind of define American popular culture and much of American government. You know, there was always sort of that dissent. I mean, there's a fascinating debate, for instance, back in the 1840s, I think, in New York City, where Bishop Dagger John Hughes, as he was called, the first Catholic bishop and archbishop of New York City, has a big public debate with the city fathers about religious instruction in schools. And he is against it, because at this point, the Catholic community in New York is very poor, and they can't build their own parochial schools. So he wants the matter to just be kind of, you know, just left out entirely in public schools. And the Protestants have all agreed on a certain set of prayers and a certain set of Bible readings that they feel constitutes just what, of course, every good American should be getting in a public school. And they're outraged that this, here's this Catholic guy who doesn't want it. You know, in some ways, very much the reverse of what goes on today. But in other words, even, you know, back then, there was this challenge to what was the mainstream, you know, received wisdom.
Well, it's probably true, and you also have, you know, we have a strong and now neglected history of, you know, radical politics, you know, with the Wobblies, for example,
yep.
And, you know, there's the Democratic Farm Labor Party, you know, there's a lot of history here that, you know, maybe tends to get glossed over, you know, that we've created a maybe an alternative history that tends to neglect some of the tensions that existed in the past, you know, even in terms of the, you know, early part of the establishment of the United States, there were rebellions all over America against,
sure.
you know, against the new nation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There were very much, I mean, places like Kentucky and all the settlements out there in Tennessee, there were a lot of people in these areas who seriously considered, before they became states, whether they should simply ask actually the Spanish Empire for protection and become a sort of their own nation or protectorate of Spain, you know, because at the time they felt the government back in Washington just taxed them on their whiskey and other things and didn't provide enough protection against the Indians, you know. So this is people, you know, people like Daniel Boone in the last years of his life actually moved into the Louisiana Territory, then controlled by Spain, and was made a public official of the Spanish crown. He was sort of a local judge and governor. You know, this is you know, this revered American frontiersman who fought in the Revolution and all. The whole ideas of what America was going to be was much more flexible at different times such as that.
Well, and that's you know, there are people today. I think there's a couple of interesting secessionist movements afoot. I know there's a small movement in Vermont, and then there's a long-standing interest on the part of northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and northern Michigan to secede from their respective states, not from the Union,
but to
create a new state called Superior, which would reflect the different lifestyle of northern Lake Superior geography. I mean, that's all. America is, in fact, a vast collection of, you know, very different people.
Oh, it's a riot. My favorite historical example is when the South tried to secede in 1861, New York City had a particularly corrupt and ambitious mayor named Fernando Wood, who seriously proposed that the city and Long Island break off and form its own country to be called, its own city-state, to be called Tri-Insula. And he pictured this as kind of being a prosperous, independent city-state. And who knows? I mean, if the South had succeeded in seceding, that might have been the case. You might have had huge other blocks of the country, such as California and, you know, parts of the West and all, maybe New England, break off and form their own countries.
Yeah, well, it seems, you know, almost miraculous that a country of this geographic size and diversity would end up as one country. It is kind of amazing.
Yeah, certainly, and we deal with that in America, the story of us talking about how, you know, the crazy as the South's attempt to form its own nation appears in some ways due to the vast material disadvantages they were at with, you know, compared to the North, what they were gambling on, it was a pretty good bet, was that nobody had ever occupied a territory or subdued a territory of that size against its occupants' wishes in the Western world. It was amazing in a way that that the North won that war.
That's a whole other discussion. Maybe we'll have to have another time. But I really want to thank you for talking to me today. I've been talking to Kevin Baker about his new graphic novel called Luna Park, L-U-N-A, which he co-authored with Danielle Zezej. It's a wonderful book. I really recommend it, and I hope people will get a chance to take a look at it. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thanks so much for having me.